is time for Scriptures for America Worldwide with Pastor Peter J. Peters. All around the world, from the United States to Canada, Europe, Russia, South Africa, Australia, the Holy Spirit is stirring the hearts of godly Christians. The Bible says, quote, as an eagle stirreth up his nest, end quote. We invite you to stay tuned as Pastor Peter J. Peters shines the mighty light of the gospel on the source of our problems and the only solution. Please keep Scriptures for America in your prayers. And now, Pastor Peters.
Greetings to the lost sheep of the House of Israel. This is Richard from the Radio Ranch here to introduce Pastor Peter's recent interview with famous author, statesman, and elder, Eustace Mullins. Pastor Peter's interviewed Mr. Eustace Mullins in January of 2009, so stay tuned for true history from a man who has lived it and wants to share it with you. And now, Pastor Peters and his January 2009 interview with Eustace Mullins.
I've been thinking about you every day.
Hello, Eustace. It's sure good to hear you. Are you doing okay?
Very good. I'm working on my autobiography and 30 other books.
Oh, wonderful. Glad to hear it. Boy, it's been a long time since I talked to you. I've just thought I would have, if I could get an interview with you, I'd just like to get it recorded, and I'd play it on the radio down the road here a ways, if that's okay.
Oh, yes, Bob. Bobby Lee has a program in Florida, and I saw a rerun of that program I did on the murder by injection, the medical conspiracy against America. That came off very well.
Eustace, did you ever think we'd come to this place of having an Obama elected?
Well, I never anticipated it. I'm not that optimistic.
Eustace, how long have you been involved in this fight for what is right?
Well, really since I went in the Air Force in 1942.
Could you tell us the story about how you met Mr. What was his name?
Ezra Pound.
Ezra Pound, yes. And that kind of got you off on this course, and you spent your whole life researching and writing and warning. Am I correct?
Oh, yes, indeed. It's always been consistent. I've always, because when I go on a particular course, I stay the course. And right now, my 86th birthday is coming up, so I'm working harder than ever.
Well, tell my audience how you got on this course by going to see Ezra Pound, would you please, and who Ezra Pound was and where he was and how he got there.
Well, Ezra Pound was an inspiration to all American youth because if you were a prospective writer or artist, Ezra Pound was held up as the ideal person to follow.
Yeah, about what time in history was that?
Well, that was in 1945 after I got out of the Air Force.
Okay.
And I had to go to the insane asylum to see him. And
now, weren't you having a course and one of your instructors suggested you go see him?
Oh, yes. He insisted I go see him because Ezra Pound had no visitors at that time because Washington, D.C. is a city of fear and everybody was afraid to go see Ezra Pound.
And why was he in an institution?
You see, he had been indicted by Alger Hiss by the Department of Justice on a charge of treason.
Uh-huh.
Aiding and giving comfort to the enemy in wartime. And this was a capital offense. He was under a death sentence. And so they asked him how he would defend himself against this charge. And he said, I'll stand by everything I ever said over Radio Rome. And when he told them that, they knew there was consternation because they knew they couldn't afford to have him repeat everything he said over Radio Rome. So they held a conference, and they got 8 psychiatrists, government psychiatrists, to say that he was unfit to defend himself.
And so
he could offer no defense.
So they put him in an institution, and that's where he was when you went to see him.
That's why he remanded to the insane asylum, because The psychiatrist never said he was insane, but they said he was incompetent to defend himself.
They couldn't afford to take the
trial. Well, they knew he was a very well-known figure, so they couldn't afford to try a person like that and have him repeat all the charges he made against Roosevelt and the Radio Rome.
Now, what is Radio Rome?
That's the official radio of the Italian government.
And he was making radio broadcasts during World War II?
He was listened to widely in the United States all through World War II because he was the most interesting commentator on the air. And he was discussing things which no one else dared to discuss. He was mentioning the Jewish problem right over the Radio Rome on Worldwide Radio.
Do you remember hearing him yourself?
Oh, I never heard him at all. I got his collected radio speeches. They were printed in a book later on, and they're available. And I quoted widely from that book in my own biography of Ezra Pound.
So you went to see him, and you started going to see him regularly after that, didn't you?
Well, I was a part-time student at an art school in Washington, and I'd just dropped the art course entirely and spent every day at the St. Elizabeth Hospital. And I began to be known as a person who could take you to meet Ezra Pound. And so people came from all over the world and looked me up and contacted me to ask if I would take them to meet Ezra Pound. Which I did, gladly enough, because I was going to see him anyway.
Uh-huh. Obviously, he became a teacher, and you learned from him. Am I correct?
Oh, he had a very wide circle of young people visiting him at the hospital. And he was quite an inspiration to all of them. These are all people my age.
Uh-huh. How old were you at that time?
25. Yeah.
What
it's a good time to meet somebody who can make an impression on you.
What did you learn from him?
I learned about the world situation for the first time. You see, I thought the United States was just one country of many countries in the world, and he gave me a unique outlook on the situation by showing what America was in the mind of the entire world, which was a land of freedom. And, of course, anything that affected freedom in the United States, people had an opinion of that.
What did he teach you concerning the Jewish issue?
Well, the Jews are the ones that put him in the insane asylum. You know, they have that power, and that's why he was committed. There was never any question about Ezra's mental capacity because people came to see him from all over the world. And no one ever heard him say anything irrational or unbelievable because he was a scholar all his life and he spoke six languages. And he could give you an opinion instantly on anything.
Uh-huh.
That's why they didn't dare try him, because he was very articulate, and I've had the same experience over the years doing radio interviews and things like that, because no one has ever asked me a question which I refused to answer.
Did he die in the institution?
No. I did a very unusual thing, because I had another friend who was a patient at St. Elizabeth Hospital named Rex Herbert Lampman. And he suffered all his life from periodic schizophrenia. And so he spent about half his life in the schizophrenic ward at St. Elizabeth. And so one day when I was going to visit Ezra Pound, I was going to visit Rex Lampman at the same time, and I thought, well, I'll see them together. because St. Elizabeth had a strict policy that inmates could not visit each other. But I took Rex over to Ezra's ward and took him in, and he was registered because he was under capital indictment, and so they had to record all people that came in to see him. So I took Rex right over there, and Ezra was sitting out alone with his wife. And we sat out there for 2 hours, and we had a great time, the two of us, because Rex knew every important person in Washington. He was the editor of the Washington Post. And so they had plenty to talk about. And I took him in and introduced Bayon, and he's very friendly. And he and Bayon started talking to each other because they hit it off very well. So I just stood aside and let them talk. And Rex said to Pound, he said, "You don't belong in here," because obviously Ezra was very rational. And so Rex said, "Well, I know that," because everybody knew that. There was absolutely nothing wrong with his mind. And so Rex said, when he told him that, he said, "You don't belong in here." He said, "I can do something about it," because he knew every important person in the city of Washington. As an editor of the Washington Post, he was the person that you had to pay attention to. And so they began to visit each other regularly. And Rex was finally discharged and moved to Los Angeles. And he and Ezra opened a very frenetic correspondence. And he had collected about 25 letters from Ezra Pound when he came to visit me in New York. And his children had helped him quite a bit by supporting him during his years of trouble. And so he visited me in New York, and my apartment was broken into. And the his luggage and clothing was all stolen. So he had 25 letters from Ezra Pound, and they were quite valuable. And they were lost and were never recovered. So they're in the hands of a dealer at the present time. But a letter from Ezra Pound is worth $800.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Could be up to $5,000 a piece. So he had 25 letters in his luggage, so those 25 letters were worth quite a bit of money. But they've never been recovered.
So you learned a lot from Ezra Pound. You got on the course that you've been on all your life. You've written a lot of books. How many books have you written now?
I have 22 published bestsellers. All of my books have sold out because I write books on which there's no... I went to the Library of Congress, I look up the Federal Reserve, there was no book on the Federal Reserve, so I had to write one from scratch. And then I wanted to write the history of the American Medical Association, the most powerful lobby in Washington, and there was no book on that. I had to write that book, and that went through three editions and sold out every time.
Are any of your books available now?
No, but I'm getting them all reprinted, and they'll be available early in this spring.
Tell me and my audience what you told me several years ago in an interview about Charles Lindbergh. You gave a whole nother picture of that era than I had at the time, particularly concerning the kidnapping of his child and the execution of the alleged kidnapper. Can you share that story with us?
Yes, indeed. They executed Richard Hoffman as a murderer because Charles Lindbergh identified him as a person he talked to in the cemetery about that case. And it was Charles Lindbergh's identification of Hoffman which led to his execution. And I later met Charles Lindbergh III and found out that there had been no kidnapping and no murder. Charles III is an accountant in San Jose, California, at present time. So I spent a couple of weeks with him, and I wanted to him to have a press conference and tell his story at an open press conference in Los Angeles. And I made all the arrangements for this and was ready to do it. And Lindbergh backed that on me. He was a person that was afraid of meeting large crowds, and he'd been through a lot, and he backed out of the whole thing. And the press conference was never held, which would have solved the whole problem. It never has been solved.
Well, tell the story as you know it then. Charles Lindbergh, you told me his son was club-footed, is that, as I recall the story?
Oh, yes. He was born with a club foot, and Lindbergh couldn't stand that, having a child who was afflicted in any way. And so he had him farmed out to a mafia group in Kansas, and he was raised on a farm in Kansas. And he saw his father from time to time. He'd come visit him. But he was later left out of Lindbergh's will. And see, Lindbergh had married the senior partner of J.P. Morgan Company, the bankers in New York. And his name was Dwight Morrow. And Lindbergh married his daughter. So she had six children by him. And so he was a senior partner of J.P. Morgan when he died. He had quite an enormous fortune. Charles Lindbergh, yeah.
He had quite a fortune when he died?
Well, he died with $6 million because he was senior partner of J.P. Morgan. And so each of his children wound up with $1 billion apiece. But Charles Lindbergh III was never allowed to participate in that. And
now, is Charles Lindbergh III the club-footed child?
Yeah. And he's retired in California. He is still trying to get his rightful inheritance.
Are you still there?
Yes.
And so you're saying, see if I got this story right, that there never was an abduction of the child?
Oh, there never was. And the body of a baby was found in the woods, but that was not Charles Lindbergh III. And in fact, it was just abandoned there.
Well, what was the purpose of all this?
Well, the police were cooperating in this. This was part of President Roosevelt's campaign to get into war with Germany. And so they used Hoffman as a German working in this country who did not have any citizenship. And they were using him as a figurehead just to get us into war against Germany.
Well, how would he be used to get us in a war with Germany?
Well, he became a symbol of German presence in this country, and they used him as a figurehead to start the war.
And they said he was a Nazi, if I recall right. Is that correct?
Well, that was absolutely ridiculous. He had no connection with any political party.
So he was just a German carpenter that was totally victimized. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. He became a victim.
And Charles Lindbergh was part of the plot?
Yes. Charles Lindbergh positively identified Charles Lindbergh as a kidnapper, although he never saw him in his life.
Would you repeat that? I didn't quite understand you.
Charles Lindbergh positively identified Halpin as the actual kidnapper, or they never saw him in his life. And justice as it's practiced in the United States.
So all this was, as I recall, the reason I recall this is because I remember as a very little boy looking in a scrapbook that my mother had put together of newspaper articles. I mean, this was big news all across America constantly about the Lindbergh baby, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was. It was the biggest story that ever happened in this country.
And
bigger than 9/11.
And
which, of course, is another fake story.
And what you're saying is there really was nothing to the whole story.
Absolutely nothing to it, because Charles Lindbergh was totally innocent. He knew nothing of Lindbergh's, and he'd never seen the baby. But they brought in a crude letter. He was a German carpenter, which meant he was a very well-known craftsman. And they had an old junky ladder, which he claimed he'd climbed up to the second story of the Lindbergh house and tried to grab the baby. And this ladder, which is exhibited in evidence, would not have held up the baby alone, much less helping himself. It was a very crude ladder.
And Hoffman could have spared his life if he would have just admitted to the crime, but he went to execution refusing to admit to something he didn't do. Is that correct?
Oh, that's correct. And his wife campaigned the rest of his life for justice to her husband's memory. But she never got any consideration whatsoever. And she died still protesting that her husband had committed no crime.
Did you ever meet her?
No, I never met her. She was around for years, and she went to newspaper offices all over the country trying to tell them the story. Of course, they wouldn't listen to her because she was not very articulate. And so the newspaper people that she talked to paid no attention to her at all. But she continued to fight for the rest of her life to clear the memory of her husband.
Quite admirable, wasn't it?
Well, admirable on her part. She never gave up on him because here the whole United States declared he was guilty, and they never had any evidence against him. See, the charges of treason against Ezra Pound were also dropped by a congressman that Rex got interested in the case. And the Department of Justice declared that they had no evidence of any kind against him.
Uh-huh.
And that's why the Department of Justice dropped the charges against him.
Now, we're getting a terrible buzz. I don't know why.
Oh, I don't know what that is. It's a cell phone.
Oh, there it is.
It stopped.
Yeah, it stopped.
Yeah.
Well, now, Eustace, your history and your story needs to be told. Are there things you want to tell right now as I record it and get it aired out on the air?
Well, I'm working on my autobiography right now, which is the story of my ancestor, William Mullins, who worked very hard in his life and never made much money. And he actually was the founder of America. Because he bought the first Mayflower for the his fellow Huguenots to come to this country, and it was declared unseaworthy, and so he had to go back and buy another boat to bring them to this country. And it was the Mayflower II, which actually landed in the United States in 1620.
Really?
Yes. And he and his wife died of the scurvy within 18 days. So he was never listed as the Society of Mayflower Defendants because in order to qualify for a group, you had to spend 30 days in this country. And, of course, he lasted only 18 days. He, his wife, and son all died, but he left a daughter
named, oh goodness, I can't think of her name now, it was Priscilla. And Priscilla Mullins married John Alden of Massachusetts, and they had their progeny included 17 presidents of the United States.
Yeah, included what again? Would you say that again?
Among their direct descendants of Priscilla Mullins and John Alden were 17 presidents of the United States.
The 17th president?
No, there were 17 different presidents.
17 presidents. Oh, I see.
Yeah. President John Adams and his son, who also became president, was named John Quincy Adams, and President Calvin Coolidge, and 14 other presidents.
Wow.
So they're sort of the founders of America.
Well, that's most interesting.
Yes, it really is. And I'm writing a biography of him right now. Because, of course, he died 18 days after he landed, and so his name is hardly known to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But he married my mother, Jane Catherine Muse, of Roanoke County, Virginia, and they had six children, and they're all hard workers like myself.
I used to carry your book, and can't get it anymore, dealing with the vaccination. What was the name of that book?
Murder by Injection.
Yes, Murder by Injection. You know,
I watched a television show I did yesterday with Bobby Lee of Florida. That's a very good interview. In fact, I think Bobby Lee could send you a copy if you asked him to. He's in Florida.
Well, Murder by Injection book was a truth before its time. Now it's starting to come out about these truths.
It reveals what goes on in this country, mass poisoning and murder every day.
By what you call the medical mafia.
Yeah, the medical mafia.
Mm-hmm.
The doctors today in this country, when you go to a doctor, he'll prescribe something for you, which has been banned by the United States government. I believe they've forbidden to sell it in this country. And many chemicals from Monsanto Chemical Company, which have been banned by the United States, are shipped to foreign countries. And the people in those countries like Mexico, they raise crops using these banned chemicals, which are forbidden for use in the United States. But if you buy Mexican grapefruit, it is raised with the aid of fertilizers, which are banned in the United States. So you're under some problem eating that grapefruit because the grapefruit is full of poison. And that's what the Federal Drug Administration does for you.
When did you write that book?
1988, and it went through three editions. It sold out three editions, and I'm trying to get it reprinted today because there's a lot of good information. You see, I did all the research for that book at the Library of Congress, as I did on all my books, and I got some amazing information there. There was a book at the Library of Congress called Medical Mussolini, which had been written, describing the head of the American Medical Association, Morris Fishbein, as a sort of a lunatic who ran the AMA as his private organization. And he was finally kicked out of the organization. The people rebelled and forced him out. And he went to England. But he himself had never practiced medicine and had no medical degree, which shows how the old setup is.
Amazing. Changing the subject, did you write or research any concerning World War II?
Oh, I wrote the whole story.
Could you share?
World War II was completely set up by Franklin D. Roosevelt. You know, he had to bribe the Japanese War Ministry to get them to attack Pearl Harbor. He paid them $140,000.
Could you tell us the story some?
Oh, yes. I haven't written that anywhere. It's in my books. But while the Japanese were on their way to attack Pearl Harbor, they had to sail the length of the Pacific. And as they were sailing through the Pacific, they weren't even on radio silence. And so hundreds of people listening to the radio heard the Japanese radio discussing their plans to attack Pearl Harbor, and the people in California were calling some of their relatives in Pearl Harbor to let them know the Japanese were attacking. And all that information was available to Roosevelt, and he claimed that it was Kimmel and Short were totally responsible and negligent because they didn't repel the invasion. But the fact is that all the communications to Pearl Harbor from the White House were sent by ordinary mail, and this attack was about to begin.
And explain to my audience why Roosevelt wanted to get us in the war so bad.
Well, as a matter of economic necessity, because all of his New Deal programs had failed to restore any prosperity to our economy, and people were still out of work. I remember 1937 was considered the worst day of the worst time of the Depression because people still were broke and they were out of work, and so it was a very grim time. My father was feeding 9 people himself, and he was making $35 a week.
I've also been told it was of necessity because his friend Stalin was about to go under and needed
our Stalin was on the point of collapse because what the German regime had done had forged a number of receipts claiming that he was bribing the general staff of the Russian army. And so he executed all his general staff. And then the Germans attacked him, and when the Germans attacked him in June of 1940, he had killed all of his general staff. He had no generals for his army.
Now, I didn't quite understand. Why had he killed the generals that he had?
The German intelligence had forged receipts and notes from the German government paying off the generals of the Russian army. And so they sent Stalin copies of these documents, and they were skillful forgeries, and they believed every one of them, so they took the generals out and shot them. And so the Germans declared war, and they had no generals for the Russian armies. And Stalin had a complete no respect to him at that point because he figured that he was going to be arrested and shot himself by the Germans. And Roosevelt sent Averell Harriman to Russia as our special ambassador, and he took over the direction of the Russian defense. And Averell Harriman was actually replaced Stalin for 2 years during World War II. And they made a comeback and won the war.
Averell Harriman had replaced Stalin. Stalin wasn't. What about the pictures and all that I see of Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt?
Well, you see those pictures, but as you know, Stalin had several doubles because he was a very ordinary man with a big hippie mustache, and you could get anybody to look like him. And so, actually, from 1942 to 1944, all the pictures you saw of Stalin meeting with Roosevelt and so forth, those were all, that was a double all of the time. because Avril Harriman was sitting in the Kremlin directing the entire Russian army for Roosevelt.
So you might say that by getting us into World War II, it saved communism.
Oh, yeah, that was called, I've always called it the war to save communism, because Hitler was then wiping out all of communism.
Now, what do you think of Hitler himself? I've always maintained they're all on the same team.
Well, he was a German patriot. And Hitler rescued Germany from the Depression, and he also rescued Roosevelt.
How do you mean he rescued Roosevelt?
Well, all of Roosevelt's New Deal programs are a total failure and didn't restore the prosperity. And when he began to rearm in preparation for the war against for World War II, he restored prosperity immediately to this country because everybody went back to work preparing for World War II.
And, of course, the way I understand it, to get us in World War II, Roosevelt got the Japanese to attack.
Yes, that's right.
And knowing that the Japanese and the Germans had a treaty together.
Yes.
And once we declared war on Japan, then naturally we were declaring war on Germany. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. That was a protocol at that time. If you were allied with somebody who attacked the United States, you had to declare a war against them. Because Hitler himself, as a politician, was very careful to avoid any war with the United States. And he was murdering German seamen on the streets of New York to try to provoke Hitler into declaring war on the United States.
You say Roosevelt was doing that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was part of the British Secret Service.
Well, didn't we also force Japan in a situation by putting an oil embargo on them where they didn't have much choice but to fight?
Well, that's exactly true. Roosevelt instituted the seizure of all assets of the Japanese people in the United States, and they just took them over. And so Japan could not help but declare war against the... they did what Roosevelt wanted them to do. They attacked the United States.
I'm curious, since I have you on the phone line here and can interview you, what is your take on Roosevelt and what he did at Dunkirk? He could have ended the war right at Dunkirk, but he didn't.
Well, the British Army was totally defeated.
That's what I'm saying. It was all over with at Dunkirk, but then he pulled back and didn't finish it.
Well, that was partly Hitler had a fondness for England all his life.
He had what?
He had a fondness for England, and the upper class of Germany and the upper class of England were very similar. They were all intermarried, and so Hitler thought it would be a gesture of goodwill to give Germany the army back. The British Army was just ready to surrender, and they were waiting for ships to England to come and take them back to England. And they managed to evacuate the entire army.
Or could it be that Hitler was taking his commands and the war was supposed to go on and not to be ended at that time?
Well, I think that they didn't want to do anything to bring the war to a quick close. They wanted to go to war to go on as long as possible.
All right. Tell me about what you know about the bombing of Dresden. That's part of history you're probably aware of that most people today are not.
Well, it was a war of extermination against the white race, because the city of Dresden was had 300,000 refugees who were just waiting there to be rescued. And so then the American Air Force and the British government set the whole thing up to have a mass bombardment of Dresden, which was a very historic German city, and they just blew it to smithereens. They leveled the whole city. Most of the people died from lack of oxygen because the mass bombing of Dresden exhausted the oxygen in that area, and most of the people died of suffocation.
That's what I understand. It was such a massive bombing day and night that it took all the oxygen out of the air, actually made the river it went through Dresden boil with as boiling water.
Oh, yes. And in fact, it's the dead bodies that in Dresden were stacked up in the streets. And we took pictures of those bodies and said they were the bodies of the Holocaust had been murdered by the Germans. Because when you get a pile of dead bodies, they're much the same. And there's no identification.
Uh-huh.
And these are all civilians.
I started reading the book on the bombing of Dresden, and I had to put it down. I couldn't stomach it.
Well, it's a horrible story.
Yes.
Well, we bombed Japan, you know, we had the B-29 bombers, which are huge cars. I was in huge planes because I was in the Air Force at that time myself. And I saw them bring in the B-29s, and they were an enormous flying machine. And they flew from Guam to Japan. It was like a mail run. They never had a start a fight against them because Japan had already was suing to surrender, but the American military leaders wouldn't even talk to them because they were saving Japan for the atomic bomb. And they hadn't finished their atomic bomb yet, so they couldn't use it against Japan. It was not until much later that it finally was ready to use against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I've been to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki war museums. They're called atomic museums.
They're called and what?
It was one of the most terrible experiences of my life. I almost passed out when I went there. It was just unrelieved horror because on the buildings they were still standing, there were shadows. And these were shadows of Japanese people who had been vaporized by the atomic bomb. And the sun was shining at this time, and the shadows were on the walls. And a really good book called The Shadows of Hiroshima was written about this by Al Perowitz. And
anyway, you said something. Let's go on where you were at about the shadows of... Go ahead.
The shadows of Hiroshima, which were the shadows of Japanese people who had been vaporized by the atomic bomb. And when I went to the Nagasaki Museum, one of the biggest pictures there was Eisenhower. Eisenhower actually risked his whole command to try to stop the atomic bomb. He did not believe in bombing civilians. And he went to with Roosevelt to Potsdam and tried to stop the plans for use the atomic bomb against Japanese civilians. And he is considered a hero in Japan today for that reason. And there's big pictures of Eisenhower in the Nagasaki Museum.
Really? I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. And Truman threatened to fire him because he refused to use the bomb. He was going to kick him out just like he did MacArthur. Truman was the biggest enemy that the American people had during his presidency.
You want to elaborate on that?
Well, he replaced somebody who was worse than he was, Franklin D. Roosevelt.
You're saying that he was worse than Franklin D.?
No, he was more patriotic than Franklin D.
Truman was.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Truman was he was the chief organizer of the Freemasons in the United States. He worked, that's the only job he ever had. He worked organizing Masonic organizations all over the state of Missouri. That's why he was elected senator.
Why was he so set on using the bomb on Japan?
Well, Truman said that all of his advisors had advised him to go ahead and use the bomb. And so he couldn't ignore the advice of his own staff.
Probably his handlers told him to do it, wouldn't you imagine?
His handlers, yes. He was just in there as a handler.
All right. Now, why did they pick Nagasaki and Hiroshima? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, they were the most revered cities in Japan. They were religious trophies. They were full of ancient temples, hundreds of years old, and they, of course they were wiped out by the atomic explosion.
While we're talking about World War II, and I've got you to talk too, I'd like to ask you a question. When they had General Doolittle that did the bombing of Tokyo?
Oh, yes.
Why didn't they pick a more strategic target like the Emperor's Palace?
Well, they never bombed the Emperor's Palace because when I went to Japan after the war, I stayed at the Palace Hotel, which is right across the street from the Emperor's Palace. And the truth is that the Emperor's Palace was never bombed during World War II.
I realize that, but wouldn't that have been a more strategic target if they're going to have a fast bombing of Tokyo like General Doolittle did?
Yeah. Doolittle chose only innocent targets. They weren't military targets at all. They were just at an ordinary neighborhoods in Tokyo.
Doesn't that seem strange?
Well, it's very strange because there are plenty of military targets in Tokyo because Tokyo is the headquarters of the military of the Japanese Army. And that's the country we're at war with at the time. And so they flew over Tokyo and just bombed Japanese civilians, civilian targets and Japanese neighborhoods, but no important targets whatsoever.
You mentioned in our conversation about the Holocaust. You want to talk about that?
Well, the Holocaust is a totally manufactured operation. Now, they call me a Holocaust denier, the Jews do, because I published a book in an edition of 10 million copies called The Secret Holocaust, in which I identified the real Holocaust as the Spanish Civil War and the French Revolution and the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Now, the targets of all three of those revolutions were the white people, and they were totally exterminated in mass exterminations. So the only extermination was of the Russian people themselves by the communists. See, Stalin killed 64 million people a year for 45 years. From 1917 to 1918, Stalin murdered 64 million people a year. And Russia's, Russia is largely depopulated to the present day because of that atrocity.
Now, are you sure your figure 64 million per year? I heard that there were 60 million altogether.
Well, it's being given today that 60 million were executed during Stalin's regime, but actually, it was actually 64 million people a year.
Yeah, I don't think the population is that big, is it?
Well, it was 200 million at the time.
That, of course, we never hear about in America. That took place in the last century.
Oh, yes.
And we're never allowed to hear about the atrocities of Stalin and the genocide that was perpetrated on those people.
No, and no one has ever been arrested. Now, this was done by the Stalin government, and everybody is liable for these executions. But no one has ever been charged under Russian law for mass murder.
Now, obviously, he was able to get by doing that because those people were disarmed. Am I right or wrong?
Oh, yes. They were disarmed, and they used fluoride in the water to keep the people subdued.
You want to talk about the fluoride? We got fluoride in our water, don't we?
Well, fluoride is described as chemical lobotomy because with every glass of water you drink, you're lobotomizing your brain. You're destroying your immune system because the human body has an excellent immune system which operates automatically to ward off any disease. And what the fluoride does, it wipes out your immune system.
Well, you're trying to tell me that the fluoride isn't put there because they're concerned about our teeth?
Oh, no. It supposedly prevents cavities in children up to the age of 7. But no studies have ever been made which bring this out. There's no, in other words, there were no studies ever. No studies were ever presented to the American medical profession that fluoride has an effect on children's teeth one way or the other.
Back on the story of the Holocaust, is it true in your research that the statistics of the number of Jews before the war and after the war prove in and of themselves that there was no Jewish Holocaust?
Oh, they do indeed. They always have been cited. In 1940, the Red Cross said there were 4 million Jews in the world. That was the total number of all Jewish people in the world. It was 4 million. They're mostly in Europe. And so there's no way you can parlay to 4 million people into 6 million. And in fact, the Jews' initial claim was after the war that 12 million Jews had been killed during the war. And so they backed up a little bit on that, finally got it down to 6 million. But that figure has no relationship to actuality.
Now, is it true that there are people that are extradited for not believing in the Holocaust and tried in right
well,
now?
Well, German writers like Irving and other people have been sentenced. I know Ernst Sandel quite well. He's a Canadian, and he's serving time in Germany right today for. He was fined $30,000 and sentenced to 10 years in prison.
For what?
Denying the Holocaust.
Just for denying the Holocaust?
Yes.
Eustace, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. And
it was an unexpected pleasure to have you call today because you called me at a good time and I had the time to go into it.
Good. Well, thank you so very much, sir, and we wish you the best. And I give you my word I'm going to keep you in my prayers.
Very good.
Thank
you,
sir.
I look forward to your next call.
Okay. Thank you, Eustace. Bye-bye.
Bye.